Still haven't quite made up my mind how we're going to do the rest of today, so we'll see how we go. We'll start off, we'll finish the overview from chapters 27 through 34, and then we'll start the process of putting together an approach to teaching the book based on what we've seen. And then perhaps what we might do at some point today is address one of the huge issues that if you're ever teaching Deuteronomy, you will have to address, because even if you aren't concerned about it, the people who are listening to you teach it will be concerned about, which is the whole issue surrounding the Canaanites and the command to deal with them. So we may revisit that later. But for now, it'd be great if you could open your Bible with me at chapter 27 of Deuteronomy as we look at these last intriguing chapters. Okay, so basically what we've seen so far is that in chapters 1 to 11, Moses reflects on the past, both in terms of Israel's failure, preeminently in chapters 1 to 3, but also a little bit in chapters 9 and 10, their failure to respond properly to the grace of God. And he also underlines the fact that the key element of a right response to the grace that God has shown them preeminently in the Exodus, but also through the wilderness wanderings, is to listen to God. You see that in the central section of 1 to 11, chapters 4 to 6, where the paradigm is established in chapter 4. We return to Horeb in chapter 5, and then in chapter 6 you have those words, the Hear, O Israel, repeated 5 or 6 times in a few verses. So people are to listen to God so that they might respond adequately to what he has done for them. Then in chapters 12 to 26, the shape of that obedient response in the land is spelled out in fairly exhaustive and at points, I suspect, fairly exhausting detail as you get through chapters 21 through 25. Lots of stipulations. They aren't even necessarily all that closely linked together. But the end result is to paint a very detailed picture of a response to grace which covers every single conceivable eventuality, not necessarily by legislating for every situation that may arise in life, but by giving this kind of broad brush approach, which makes it clear that God's grace has a bearing on everything that may arise. Even, for example, as we saw in 25:11 and 12, the case of the immodest lady wrestler. I think part of the reason why that is there is to show that there is no situation which could possibly arise on which the grace of God and the obedient response has no bearing. Okay. Then we got to chapter 26. Moses holds that back right to the end of his discussion to make a very powerful conclusion to the law, where he draws together much of the elements that are there, saying that the response in the present to God's grace in the past and the present is built around worshiping God in the way that he says, right relationships, so you draw in those on the fringes to celebrate with you, to do exactly what God has asked for you in the land which he has given you. Okay, so that's where we've got to at the end of chapter 26. Now, anybody any questions so far? Or anything you want to pick up from yesterday? Okay, let's jump into 27 then. When you get to the beginning of chapter 27, Moses tells them to do something very specific. Let me read a few words. Then Moses and the elders of Israel commanded the people, keep all these commands that I give you today. Again, start of a new section, you have the command, laws, statutes, language, recurring again. Keep all these commands that I give you today, 27:2. When you've crossed the Jordan into the land that the Lord your God is giving you, set up some large stones and coat them with plaster. That's a recurring theme. You'll find it again in the early chapters of Joshua. Write on these stones all the words of this law when you've crossed over to enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, a land flowing with milk and honey, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you. And when you've crossed the Jordan, set up these stones on Mount Ebal, as I command you today, and coat them with plaster. Build there an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. Don't use any iron tool upon them. Build the altar of the Lord your God with stones from the field and offer burnt offerings on it to the Lord your God. Sacrifice fellowship offerings, eating them and rejoicing in the presence of the Lord your God. and you shall write very clearly all the words of this law on these stones you have set up. So, you go into the promised land. What's the first thing you do? You set up these stones. This monument to remind the nation of all that's gone before, the grace of God that he's brought them back into the land, and also by the very, very obvious act of writing the law on these stones, you remind each other, remind the whole nation, that God's grace demands a response in the land, in the present. Now, just in case the stones weren't big enough to remind them, Moses then suggests they do something else. And then the ritual that he prescribes from verse 9 is very interesting. Here's what he says. Then Moses and the priests who are Levites said to all Israel, "Be silent, O Israel, and listen. You have now become the people of the Lord your God," preeminently through the Exodus. "Obey the Lord your God and follow his commands and decrees that I give you today." On the same day, Moses commanded the people, "When you've crossed the Jordan, these tribes shall stand on Mount Gerizim to bless the people: Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Joseph, and Benjamin. And these tribes shall stand on Mount Ebal to pronounce the curses: Reuben, Gad, Asher, Zebulun, Dan, Naphtali. The Levites shall recite to all the people in a loud voice." There you go. Cursed. In a long, long list of cursing. Okay? Now, a couple of very interesting things here. This is on a kind of double hill at Shechem, modern Nablus, which is visible from a fair distance away in a fair part of Israel. So the idea is, as Israel is in the land, once they move out into the land, a lot of them are still able to look back, see this double-pronged hill, and remember this very simple ritual, where half the nation go up one side, half the nation go up the other, and one group of tribes enunciates blessings, and the other group enunciates curses. Okay? Now, just looking at chapter 27, what's missing?
Blessings.
Yeah. No mention made of the blessings, which is very strange, because you get the curses spelled out in quite some detail. Some of them are drawn from the Decalogue, Ten Commandments, some of them aren't, which in and of itself is an interesting thing. I haven't got the definitive answer for this, but it has always puzzled me slightly why there isn't more reference in the Old Testament to the Ten Commandments, to the Decalogue. Anybody think of anywhere in the Old Testament where the ten words, where the Decalogue is clearly referenced? It's reassuring. I don't think I'm being completely stupid. But it is quite strange. You would think, you know, when you think the prominence that in many of our traditions we give to the Ten Commandments, one would expect that there would be more reference. Now, you know, there is a huge amount of referencing the law as a whole and aspects of the law, and at times one or two of the Ten Commandments. I mean, please don't mishear me. I'm not trying to, you know, kind of undermine the place of the Ten Commandments as, in a way, the foundation of everything that follows. But it is quite striking that through the rest of the Old Testament, you know, you never hear, or seldom hear, anyone say anything like, "Well, you must keep the Ten Commandments." And I think Deuteronomy actually provides the answer for that. Because what has happened is you have these kind of ten condensed, you know, very condensed statements, like a kind of foundational summary, which is then expanded in Exodus 19 to 24 for the escaping slaves, which is then picked up again and reapplied in Deuteronomy for life in the land. But you have almost this, evolving's the wrong word, but continually reapplied body of law. And so Israel's concern is to live it out rather than continually going back to the quite abstract set stipulations. If you have any comments on that to help me, as I think this thread, I'd be very glad. But I think it is quite noticeable that it's the law as a whole that tends to be referenced rather than the Decalogue. But here the important thing is that you have this list of curses that are drawn more or less from the Ten Commandments, and the blessings aren't spelled out. Now, why do you think that is? Curses are thought to be more relevant. I think that's the obvious answer. It's as if Moses says, okay, Some of you go up, you know, we'll have half the tribes, they'll go up and they'll shout blessings. The other half will go up and shout curses. Here are the curses. Oh, you guys, you won't, yeah, you'll not really need the blessings. They won't really apply. Okay? Now, could that be the explanation? We'll read on into chapter 28. What do you find in chapter 28? You do find blessings. But in chapter 28, you also find curses. Now, what's the relative balance of the blessings and curses? Many verses of blessings? 14. How many of curses? How many? 50, yeah, that's right. We'll not fall out over the maths and the verse divisions. But you get the point. There are 54 or so verses dealing with the curses and 14 dealing with the blessings. Okay. Now, again, what does that sound like? Sounds like the curses, well, Moses seems to think that Israel will be much more likely to experience curse than blessing, that Israel at least has a propensity to disobey, and so will feel the weight of these curses. It's a little like the rhetorical, at a very simple level, the rhetorical pattern that we found in Joshua 1 yesterday. You know, if you keep on saying to someone, be strong and courageous, now don't wimp out, I don't want you to compromise on this one, you must not compromise, it becomes fairly clear that you think the person involved is going to compromise. So similarly, as Moses talks about the blessings and the curses and gives a short, concise, full exposition of the blessings and then goes on and on and on and on and on and on about the curses, it starts to sound like he thinks that people are going to mess up and that sooner or later they will experience the curse of disobedience. Okay? Now, the net effect of all that is to set up that visual aid of Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim in a very particular way. That whilst, yes, it is a reminder of the blessings that will be theirs if they live obediently in response to grace in the promised land, that actually it's a much more potent warning of the danger of disobedience and the necessary consequences if they turn away from God. Okay? And you see, this just sort of screams out at us from the waiting given in the text. And it's not as if, you know, in chapter 28, it's not, and when you take 27 and 28 together, you end up with a kind of curse sandwich. You know, you get a short list of curses, and then you get a short list of blessings, and then a huge list of curses. You know, so it's not just, you know, there are 17 words for the blessings and, you know, 20 for the curse. It's massively disproportionate, which has to have some impact on the way in which we read the book. Okay. Anybody, any questions on that?
We're using iron made a chisel, that sort of thing. Is there any significance?
I think that the reference to iron in making the altar, I think it's part of the rhetoric, which we'll see again in a minute and runs right through the laws, which says you must be different from the Canaanites. So the Canaanites, the people in the land, were an Iron Age culture. You know, they had chariots, very large beds. At this stage, Israel seems to have minimal access to iron. So as they go into the land right at the start, I mean, Moses doesn't say, you know, don't get into that iron thing, but right at the start, as they lay down a marker which reminds them where they've come from and they must be distinctive, it seems that the prohibition of using an iron instrument to make that initial monument is another reminder that they have a different origin, that they are a different people. And they are to live in the way the Lord requires, not just to adapt to all the cultures of Canaan. Yep.
Carry on. The tribe of Levi is on the blessing hill, but then the one
who's Yes. Yeah. Yep. The, yes. The, I mean, that's another I think that's another example that even though they're on the blessing hill, that from the blessing hill you get the Levites giving the curse. It's a very odd thing, but I think it actually heightens this isn't just a kind of 50-50, but that even from the Mount of Blessing comes the word of cursing. And it's also significant that from the fact that it's coming from the Levites, who have a special, in the book, in Deuteronomy, they function as a reminder that relationship with God is ultimate, because they don't have any land. You know, they are the tribe where it is said that God himself is their inheritance. So to have them announce the curse, it's almost as if they are speaking in the place of God as the representatives of a relationship with God in that kind of priestly way. So, okay, so keep going. Let's go into chapter 29. Oh, well, let me just say that it is very clear. Let's pick up the end. The end of the curses. There's a massive amount of material in there. I mean, the curse takes various kind of metaphorical and literal characteristics. The ultimate curse will be that people will be that God's people will be taken into captivity, that they will be sent back to Egypt. Now that seems to be metaphorical. All the diseases of Egypt fall on them, which is an undoing of the Exodus. Now again, we've already seen Moses doing this right at the start of the book. Remember, the Exodus goes into reverse. He very deliberately says you're heading back the way you came towards the Red Sea. And in the curses it said, if you disobey, you will end up going back to Egypt. So that is back to slavery rather than freedom, back to a land of captivity rather than a land of freedom. In verses like, for example, verse 36, this is described in terms of losing their freedom. The Lord will drive you and the king you set over you, interestingly, to a nation unknown to you or your fathers. There you will worship other gods, gods of wood and stone. You will become a thing of horror and an object of scorn and ridicule to all the nations where the Lord will drive you. That's a complete undoing of the promise of Abraham. That instead of God's people being this group of people who respond to his grace and live in the freedom provided by his law, so that everybody says, what a marvelous God you have, what a great nation you are, what great laws. They're actually an object of scorn and ridicule. Everything is turned on its head. So this is the kind of anti-type of the Abraham promise. God will bring other nations against them. Swarms of locusts show up, verse 42. Verse 43, the alien who lives among you will rise above you higher and higher, but you will sink lower and lower. He will lend to you, but you will not lend to him. He will be the head, but you will be the tail. So there's the complete reversal. Rather than Israel being the blessing to the nations, Israel becomes both oppressed by and kind of has a trickle-down blessing from the nations. Okay, all these curses, verse 45, will come upon you. They will pursue you and overtake you. Now, let's go to verse 64. Let's jump ahead. Again, sorry, well, it's verse 63. Just as it pleased the Lord to make you prosper and increase in number, so it will please him to ruin and destroy you. You will be uprooted from the land you're entering to possess. Again, you've got the reversal of the promise to Abraham. Okay, as God multiplied you, so you'll be diminished. As he took you into the land, so you'll be expelled. Verse 64. Then the Lord will scatter you among all the nations from one end of the earth to the other. There you will worship other gods again, gods of wood and stone which neither you nor your fathers have known. Among those nations you will find no repose, no resting place for the sole of your foot. There the Lord will give you an anxious mind, eyes weary with longing and a despairing heart. You will live in constant suspense, filled with dread both night and day, never sure of your life. In the morning you will say, if only it were evening, and in the evening, if only it were morning, because of the terror that will fill your hearts and the sights that your eyes will see. The Lord will send you back in ships to Egypt. Obviously the ships thing shows it's a metaphor, because It's not an obvious way to get from where they were to Egypt. The Lord will send you back in ships to Egypt on a journey I said you should never make again. There you will offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but no one will buy you. Be utterly worthless. Okay? Now, that is essentially talking about the exile. And for Moses, exile is the reversal of all the promises of God. Okay? I mean, in this chapter, he talks about them all. It's not just about the land. It's about diminishing rather than increasing. It's about, in effect, losing their relationship with God. Exile is the consequence of rebellion against God. Okay? Happy enough with that? Okay. Then, chapter
29. 28, verse 28 and 29, the curse for the blindness. Is there any relevance to the Paul's experience of blindness on the way to Damascus?
Never thought of that. Have to look at how it's described in Acts, maybe. Maybe that Luke could possibly be picking up that language, but would have to check. But again, you know, that's another element. You know, the Lord will afflict you with madness, blindness, and confusion of mind. I mean, if you took the time to work through this chapter and write down all the aspects of curse, I mean, it is just devastating. You know, particularly when you read it against the early parts of the book, which are so positive in terms of describing the blessing, even the list of blessings just a chapter earlier. You have wholeness and health and enjoyment and delight with God, and things are right with other people, and this is the flip side of that. Okay? So does it end on a bleak note? Well, let's see. Chapter 29. These are the terms of the covenant the Lord commanded Moses to make with the Israelites in Moab, in addition to the covenant he had made with them at Horeb. Very striking statement. Okay? You know, because Horeb as the foundational moment of Israel's national covenant. So you have the promises to Abraham, kind of spelled out in broad covenantal terms. Then the next stop on the covenantal journey through the Old Testament is at Horeb at Mount Sinai, where you have Israel constituted as a people, royal priesthood, the holy nation, picking up aspects of the Abrahamic promise. And now you have another stop, which we don't normally incorporate. You know, if you had to write down a list of the covenantal passages in the Bible, you know, the normal, well, you go, you know, maybe Noah, you know, or depending on your theological perspective, you know, was it a covenant with Adam and all? But, you know, okay, so you start with Adam in some way, something to do with Noah, Abraham, Moses and the Exodus, David is generally the next place, 2 Samuel 7. But Moses introduces another one, this covenant made in Moab, kind of in the middle of nowhere. Now, what's he going on about? Well, having just read chapters 26, 27, and 28, it's pretty clear that this is a mess, that this needs a solution. You know, that if Moses is right in what he says, that whilst they may experience a little bit of blessing, he seems fairly convinced that the curse will come and they will be exiled. That what we're looking for in chapter 29, at least if you imagine you're sitting there in front of him on the grass listening, you really want a solution. You want some kind of alternative at best, or at least. Well, this is what he provides. But remember the way in which Deuteronomy works. Okay? Think back to, if you were with us yesterday, remember Moses has this habit of saying, these are the commands and laws, and then not telling you straight away what they are. It's like his way of saying, they are coming. You may have to wait a little bit. So he'll say, these are the commands.